1. Exordium, 1975-1976. Like all show business successes, Saturday Night Live had many fathers. Several mothers, too. There is still, so many years after the birth, disagreement over who the real father is. The show had a gestation period of more than a year, during which the concept took various forms, none identical to that of the show we know today. Adjustments and refinements continued after the premiere. Whatever the evolutionary variations in structure and format, however, Saturday Night Live was from the beginning a lone pioneer staking out virgin territory and finding its way in the night, its creative team determined to make it television's antidote to television. To all the bad things, corrupt, artificial, plastic, facile, that TV entertainment had become.
Rosie Schuster, writer. Lorne Michaels arrived in my life before puberty, let's put it that way. I swear to God, there was not a pubic hair in sight when he arrived on my doorstep. We were living in Toronto in the same neighborhood. I was with my girlfriend. We were jumping on boards, just letting go. We were just wild, prepubescent kids, and Lorne observed me from the sidelines. And I guess he was struck by my mojo or whatever, and he basically started following me around. We were inseparable after that.
Howard Shore, music director. As kids, Lorne and I went to a co-ed summer camp in Canada, and that was really the beginning of our friendship. I was 13, and Lorne must have been about 15. Rosie Schuster was there, too. We did shows you do at summer camp, like Guys and Dolls, The Fantastics, things like that. And on Saturday nights we did The Fast Show, a show Lorne and I put together quickly, hence the title. We did comedy, we did sketches, we had kind of a repertory company and some musicians. If you think about it, it was truly the beginning of Saturday Night Live, because it was a show we put on every Saturday night, and it was a live show, and it was somewhat improvisational with comedy and music. We always had a bunch of people around us who were writers and actors even at that age. And that kind of progressed from summer camp to other things that Lorne and I wrote together.
Rosie Schuster. My dad really mentored Lorne in terms of comedy. Lorne had a partner and did radio shows just like my dad had done, and then CBC specials just like my dad had done. I saw the whole thing unfold, and felt like Saturday Night Live was so much a part of something that grew from my home. Something about the show came from inside my family. Lorne visited my dad inside his little showbiz pup tent, where he shared his wild enthusiasms. Lorne was a very avid, eager sponge for all of it. He heard all of the names of everybody backstage at the Ed Sullivan Show, and all the ins and outs of the movies. My dad grew up watching the Marx Brothers and Chaplin. He was just spellbound by all of that, and he shared that love with me and with Lorne.
Lorne Michaels, executive producer. I grew up in Canada, where we had all three American networks and later a Canadian network. So I was watching CBS and ABC when I was 8 or 9, and grew up on the same television that everybody else grew up with. I saw the same kind of movies, but my grandparents owned a movie house, and my mother worked in it, and my uncle had been a projectionist. The Playhouse on College Street. My mother, who died in 2001, could still play music from the silent movies, from the sheet music the movie companies sent around. My maternal grandmother, who was an enormous influence on me, and my aunts and uncles, and my mother, of course, all talked about movies and show business in whatever form, and books. That was all a part of my growing up. I don't think I ever thought that's what I'd be doing with my life, although when I was at my peak seriousness, at 22 or 23, I thought I'd be a movie director. In 1972, I had presented this pilot to the CBC. They said they were thinking about it, but the head of the CBC, whose name I am clearly blocking, said to me one afternoon when I was talking passionately about why this show would be a breakthrough show, he said, "If you're that funny, why are you here?" And I thought, oh my God, it's that Canadian thing of if you're good, you go to America. Sandy Wernick, agent. When I met Lorne, he was in Canada, producing and starring in The Hart and Lorne Hour with his partner, Hart Pomerantz. I had never met anybody who had a gift of gab like Lorne. He would just mesmerize me with what he was talking about. If you talked about comedy, all of a sudden he would just light up and turn on. I remember introducing him to Bernie because I knew that would be a marriage. Bernie Brillstein, manager. I met him when he was working on Laugh-In with his partner, who wound up going back to Canada. We were doing the Burns and Schreiber summer show with Jack Burns and Avery Schreiber, and there was a spot for a writer. Sandy Wernick from ICM told me Lorne was available. I said to bring him in to fill the last slot. And I fell in love with him. He wanted to know about old show business, and he had done a short film, The Hockey Puck Crisis, which was great. Hockey pucks grew on trees, and there was a blizzard that destroyed the crop, so they couldn't play hockey in Canada that year. Being a hockey fan and a comedy fan, I thought it was hysterical. Lorne Michaels. Bernie's a larger-than-life character. He was also an antidote, because I was deadly serious about everything I was doing in those days. Bernie had the gambler's love of the sheer larceny of it, whether it was hee-haw or whatever. It didn't seem to matter. He knew the good stuff from the bad stuff, but it didn't stop him from dealing with either. Whereas I thought if I was involved with anything bad, it would destroy my life.
Rosie Schuster. I had done television shows with Lorne in Toronto and in Los Angeles. On one of Lily Tomlin's specials, we did Arresting Fat People in Beverly Hills together. Bernie Brillstein played one of the fat people. Vertical stripes, you know? Only vertical stripes. It got nominated for an Emmy. Lily Tomlin, host. Lorne was used to being a star back in Canada. We were quite close at that time. When Lorne worked with me on my specials, he would spend too much time editing and being too fanatical about everything. Jane Wagner would say, "You're going too far, and you're spending too much money, and the show needs to be rougher." Lorne and I would get into the editing room and get too perfectionistic, you know? I must say, I think some illegal substances had something to do with it.
Robert Klein, host. I remember before there was any Saturday Night Live, and actually humble Lorne Michaels used to come to the office of my manager, Jack Rollins. Lorne was a kid from Canada, married to Rosie Schuster, who was the daughter of Frank Schuster of Wayne and Schuster, the duo that used to be extremely unfunny on The Sullivan Show years ago. Lorne was looking for some work, and Jack was very helpful to him. Tom Schiller, writer. My father, Bob Schiller, was working on this show called The Beautiful Phyllis Diller Show in 1968, and he said there was a junior writer on the show that he'd love me to meet. And I said, "Why?" And he said, "Well, he knows all of the best restaurants in L.A. So one day Lorne comes over wearing a Hawaiian shirt. He seemed like a nice enough guy, a little nebbish, you know. What struck me, though, was that after my dad introduced me, Lorne lit up a joint right there in the house. I was scared, but I was impressed, too, that he had the boldness to do that. We sort of became friends, and I started hanging out with him at the Chateau Marmont. CBS still ruled the ratings in the mid-1970s, but executives at RCA, which owned NBC, had high hopes for the network's aggressive and competitive new president, Herbert Schlosser, a one-time Wall Street lawyer who took over in 1974. He was anxious to make his mark on television history, and he would. Dick Ebersol, NBC executive. In the spring of 1974, I was approached by NBC to come over there and essentially run their sports department. At that time, I was Rune Arledge's assistant at ABC. I said no. I think they were like in shock. How could somebody who was 27 turn that down? But I felt they didn't take sports seriously, that they wouldn't put real resources into it. And besides, I didn't want to compete against the best person who'd ever done it before or since, Rune. My saying no apparently impressed Herbert Schlosser, the president of NBC. So, lo and behold, in the summer of 1974, Schlosser invited me to his place on Fire Island, along with Marvin Antonowski, one of his programming executives, and essentially laid out the whole thing, how Johnny Carson had given them fair warning that he did not want weekend repeats of The Tonight Show to exist after the summer of 1975. They had begun to order up some specials. One had Burt Reynolds sort of hosting. It was talky and had some comedy bits. Herb said he was very much interested in finding some regular stuff for that time period. I was intrigued, even though I had no background whatsoever in late night. I'd been a sports kid since I dropped out of Yale to work for Roon in 1967. I told Roon I was leaving the same morning Nixon resigned. I had a whole deal to come over to NBC as head of weekend late-night programming. I had 1 year to come up with a show to go into that time period, and if the show was creatively sound, I had Herb's word it would get at least 6 months on the air. Herbert Schlosser, NBC president. I had played a role in hiring Ebersol. I can remember when I interviewed him. It was out on Fire Island on a weekend, and he was wearing a pair of pants where one leg was one color and the other leg was another color, which, I guess, is what you wore in Connecticut. Johnny Carson was the biggest star NBC had, unchallengeable in his time period. It wasn't like Leno and Letterman fighting each other now. Johnny was very, very important to the network, and we were getting emanations that he was not pleased about the weekend repeats of his show. They'd been on for 10 years, and we ourselves weren't that thrilled, but it had been an easy thing for us to do, just put them on. So, I thought we should try something new. Fred Silverman, NBC president. When Herb looks back on his days at NBC, he's the only guy that had worse days than I did. He really doesn't have much of a positive nature to look back at. So I can see where he would remember the beginnings of the show so well. Saturday Night Live was a big deal for him. It was Herb's biggest endeavor. Grant A. Tinker, former NBC chairman. I think Herb Schlosser gets credit for letting Saturday Night Live happen, or even causing it to happen, for all I know. And I think that's particularly important because Herb is such a tight-ass guy. And the fact that it started on his watch says a lot. I'm not sure if it would have started on mine. I give Herb credit because he's the one who would take the heat when there was heat from the RCA directors or whatever. Those were very straight guys, in the old-fashioned sense of the word. On the 53rd floor where RCA had its offices, there wasn't a laugh in a carload up there. Dick Ebersol. I spent September and October of 1974 roaming the West Coast, Canada, Chicago, and New York, looking for comics and comedy producers. I came to the conclusion rather quickly that the only way this show would work would be if the young embraced it, if it was a show for a younger audience. Johnny was the most brilliant person in the world, but his show wasn't for teenagers. One piece of talent I thought would give us credibility was Richard Pryor. We had these meetings with Richard, and they went fairly well. He finally agreed to a deal. After that, Lily Tomlin agreed to fall in. So did George Carlin. Someone was trying to sell me Steve Martin and Linda Ronstadt as a twosome. While all this was going on, Sandy Wernick at ICM, who had Lorne as a client, set up a meeting for us in L.A. I didn't know Lorne, but discovered he had substantial credits in specials and that he'd been involved in Laugh-In'. Lorne pitched an idea based on Kentucky Fried Theater. I decided right away that it wasn't for me. I just didn't really dig it. But Lorne and I hit it off. Meantime, I'm buying up a lot of talent. Just after Christmas of 1974, I get a phone call from a manager lawyer in Atlanta, now dead, who says that he represents Richard Pryor and has convinced Richard that television is a disaster and whatever career he has, he'll never be able to do what he does well on over-the-air television. He could not be himself. So the deal was off. I came back right after the 1st of January and told Schlosser that Pryor was out. Some day subsequent to that, he wrote me a memo and said, "Why don't you bring the show back to New York and even think about doing it in old Studio 8H? So that part was his idea. Use 8H. Then I got hold of Lorne, the closest contemporary to me I'd met in this whole process. He did not have an idea at this point. We goof now about the number of people who've talked about how the idea was sold to NBC. No idea was sold to NBC. I adore Bernie Brillstein, but anything in his book about selling an idea, it never happened. Get the lie detectors out, ask Lorne. It's all bullshit. What did happen was that Lorne just took my breath away in the way he talked about things, how he wanted to have the first television show to speak the language of the time. He wanted to be the first show in the history of television to talk, absent expletives, the same language being talked on college campuses and streets and everywhere else. And I was very taken with that, among other things. So I told NBC there were two people I wanted to do the show, which would be a live comedy show from New York. I wanted this guy Lorne Michaels to produce it, and I wanted a guy named Don Ohlmeyer to direct it. Bernie Brillstein. You know that at one point NBC suggested Rich Little as the host? I swear to God, we had a meeting with a guy named Larry White. He was head of NBC programming, and we went to see him with the first real pitch of Saturday Night Live ever. Lorne told him what he wanted to do, and Larry White said, "That's the worst idea I've ever heard in my life." Dick Ebersol. The night Lorne picked me up at the Beverly Hills Hotel to go see Kentucky Fried Theater, he never said a word about being married, there was this really, really gorgeous dish who got out of the front seat and into the back seat. So we all went to this play, and Lorne and I sat together, and this girl sat next to me. And they had introduced her as Sue Denim, because Rosie loved having these various names. And we finally got back to the Beverly Hills Hotel, and I'm thinking, this girl is really a knockout and smart as hell. Maybe I ought to ask her out. Because I wasn't anywhere near married in those days. And at some point, when we walked into the hotel to have a drink, it came out that she and Lorne were married, though they weren't living together at that time. But I know they pulled the wool over my eyes for at least 3 hours.
Rosie Schuster. Dick thought that I was procured for his delight or something. There was a little fuzziness around my introduction. Marilyn Suzanne Miller, writer. Other than Herb Sargent, I was the television veteran of Saturday Night Live, which is to say I had worked in TV for 2.5 or 3 years, and I had started on the Mary Tyler Moore Show, having had the sort of Lana Turnerish Schwab's discovery made of me by Jim Brooks, aided and abetted by Gary Marshall. So I was writing Mary Tyler Moore and Rhoda at 22, and I was on the staff of The Odd Couple. I met Michael O'Donohue and Ann Beatz through a friend when I was doing Rhoda and living in New York. When Lorne was putting the show together and asked me to be a part of it, I had an overactive thyroid and was living with this guy I really wanted to be with. So I told Lorne, "I can't do the show because I want to get married, but you've got to hire this guy O'Donohue because he's brilliant." Lorne, of course, had his own access to the Second City people and already knew Chevy, which had nothing to do with Michael. So, thanks to me, Michael O'Donohue got hired. Ann Beatz, writer. I was living a very sort of style-based existence with Michael O'Donohue, which was severely crimped by the fact that he'd quit the Lampoon, and we were completely broke. Michael was rather laid low by the whole experience. At one point I had achieved this thing where we had a gig doing restaurant reviews for the Village Voice. Every reporter's dream, right? And free meals! And it was Christmas time, and Michael and I co-wrote a review of Lu Chow's, this restaurant where Diamond Jim Brady had gone to romance Lillian Russell. It was very Christmassy because it had a giant Christmas tree in the middle of it. Anyway, Michael insisted on putting some reference to Hiroshima and the Nazis into the review. The Village Voice did not go for this, especially in a restaurant review. Michael quit in a huff and we lost the gig, and I was like, oh no! We were at the bailout point when Lorne showed up and offered first Michael and then me jobs on Saturday Night Live. And I turned it down because I had sold a book, Titters, the first collection of humor by women. I said, I can't do this stupid television show. And then a friend of mine was like, are you crazy? You have to do it. And thank goodness I did. So then Michael and I were working on it together.
Dick Ebersol. NBC set up a meeting for 8 o'clock in the morning, and Lauren said, "Dick, 8 o'clock? You know I can't function at that hour." I said, "Lauren, it's breakfast. We've got to do it." Bernie Brillstein. Lauren said, "I can't get up." I said, "Lauren, this is the one time I'll call you and get you up." Dick Ebersol. So he came to this breakfast, I don't know if he'd even been to bed, and he's sitting with these two guys who, despite whatever nice things they did for me, I have to give the title of stiffs. They're basically asking if Connie Stevens is going to do the show. Lauren goes into his best BS. When it's over, they say, "Well, he's awfully young, but okay, you can have him." The next morning I bring in Ohlmeyer, who's more akin to their world, and they liked him very much. But Roone would not let Don out of his contract at ABC, and it would be almost 2 years before NBC got Don away from them. Herbert Schlosser. I wanted to do the show live, if possible, and I wanted to do it in New York City because New York had lost all of its entertainment shows. Everything had moved to Burbank. Even Carson had moved to Burbank, which left a void in 30 Rock. I originally thought it should be 2 hours and so forth. But the research department was very conservative. Nobody seemed to be enthusiastic at the meeting. Now, I'd had an experience with the Tomorrow Show, which I didn't want to repeat. I had always wanted to put it on, and we went through the procedure as you should of having a financial analysis and a research analysis and so forth. But I never could get an answer from my own network people. So I was talking to Julian Goodman, who was the chairman of NBC, about my frustration with my ideas for Saturday night, and he said to me, "You should just call Les Brown, the reporter from Variety. Have lunch with him and just tell him you're putting the show on." So I did, and it was in Variety a couple days later. Sure enough, the wheels started moving more rapidly. Dick Ebersol. I would go to the Chateau Marmont, where Lorne lived, and basically for 9 or 10 days, between going out to dinner and all this stuff, we worked out a loose thing of what this show was going to be. It's going to be a repertory company of 7, and a writing staff, and fake commercials, and all that. Bernie Brillstein. About this time, Lorne invited me to his birthday party, his 30th, I think. The only party ever held in the lobby of the Chateau Marmont, where they all used to stay. So the party supposedly starts at 9. I was the old man of the group, so I arrive at 9:30. And there's not a soul there. Not one. And finally Lorne comes down in slacks and pajama tops, just waking up or something. He said people would be there in a while. This is so Lorne. And about 11 o'clock, here's who walks in. Richard Pryor, Lily Tomlin, George Carlin, the entire underground of Hollywood comedy. And that's when I knew Lorne was a real somebody. Neil Levy, production assistant. Lorne's a cousin of mine, and he had brought Paul Simon up to a cottage where I was staying. I didn't actually know who he really was. That's what an idiot I was. I asked him if he was from Simon and Garfunkel. He said, "Yeah, used to be." They had broken up 4 years earlier. I didn't even know. I did some magic tricks for Paul Simon. I think that impressed Lorne. After that, he took me down on the dock and asked me if I wanted to be his assistant on this new show. Oh, man, I think my bag was already packed. I thought I had died and gone to heaven. I was 19 when I first came on the show, the youngest person on the staff. I just watched the whole thing come together with all these famous people slowly gravitating toward the show. I slept on Lauren's couch for a couple of weeks, long before the show ever started, and one day I came in and Mick Jagger was sitting there, in Lauren's apartment, on the couch. I don't know how Lorne knew Mick Jagger, because at that point he wasn't even Lorne Michaels, but people were drawn to him. Robert Klein. Some time had passed between when I met Lorne and the formation of this show. Next thing I know, I was immediately sought out as the host. Lorne came down to see me with Chevy Chase, who'd been in Lemmings, and checked me out at the bitter end on Bleecker Street in Greenwich Village. And I remember Lorne suggesting, he was no longer humble, that I should be more vulnerable in my act. He said this not directly to me, but through my manager, Jack Rollins. Anyway, it was definitely agreed that I had too big a reputation already to be, quote, one of the kids, but that I should host the show. Albert Brooks, filmmaker. Here's how Saturday Night Live came about. I was doing clubs and performing a lot, and Lorne used to come a lot to the shows. I knew that he was a fan, and something was brewing. They decided, I think around September of 1974, that they were, in fact, going to open up 11:30 on Saturday. I was first approached in the late fall, early winter of 1974. I was sort of asked by Dick Ebersol if I wanted to have a show, be the permanent host every week. Lorne Michaels was around. I mean, you know, it was both of them. I think I met with Ebersol alone, and Lorne alone, and then both of them together. But that was the first time I heard, do you want to host your own show? And I actually had just done a short film. I wrote this article in 1971 for Esquire, the famous school for comedians. PBS had that Great American Dream Machine, which was a show of short films, so I made the famous school for comedians into, like, a fake infomercial, and it was hugely successful. The PBS stations ran it during pledge drives, and it just turned out to be a great experience for me. So this is what I wanted to do. But in any case, I knew I didn't want to do television, and I told that to Ebersol and Michaels. And then, you know, a month later they come back. This is going to be a big thing. Why don't you do it? Now, as I did with everything, every time I said no to someone in my life, I always felt compelled to come up with an alternative idea so I didn't sound like an asshole. So I swear to God on my own life, I said to them, you don't want a permanent host anyway. Every show does that. Why don't you get a different host every week? And so I really have to tell you, when I said that, they both went, oh, okay. So that was my suggestion. Lorne Michaels. Wait a minute. I made the presentation to NBC on April 1st, and I didn't talk to Albert until June. So what do you think was in the proposal? But Albert felt, as did a ton of other people in that first year, that they had a big part in the creative effort of the show. It was a big part of their identity. Albert Brooks. Then November, December, January, I get another call. They had not really done anything. They hadn't proceeded in any one direction. So what was said to me was, we want you involved. And at that time there were no cast members. There was nothing. I think serious auditions started in the late spring. So I said, I want to get into the film business. I want to make short films. What if I make a short film for you? They all liked the idea, and they all said yes. But they didn't have a show yet, so, you know, no one had thought far enough ahead to think, well, gee, okay, so then this show is going to have at least a short film. Now, in turn for that, what I did for them is that in February or early March, there was a junket at the Sheraton Universal for the affiliates about the new season. You know, you'd walk in and the guy from New Orleans would put a palm tree and a bottle of booze there, and you'd stand in front of it and he'd say, welcome to New Orleans, Albert. I was standing with Lorne, and the day was filled with people asking the same question. So what's this new show going to be about, Albert? And I said, I'm going to do some short films, but I don't really know anything other than that. Then Lorne said, well, we're not sure, but, you know, we're going to do cutting-edge comedy. So I am positive that I was the first person brought on, because I never saw anybody else, and nobody else was ever mentioned. Dick Ebersol. Long before anyone else, Albert had signed on to do those short films. They were inordinately important, because if you look at the early shows, it's not really until show 10 or 11, with the exception maybe of Candy Bergen, show 4, that you see anything roughly akin to what the show evolved into. So Albert's stuff from the beginning was wildly important, and it came from just running into him one day on Sunset Boulevard. Albert Brooks. I always said one thing to these guys, and they didn't take my advice, and in this case I'm sure it's good they didn't, but I said, this live stuff, it's absolutely meaningless to me. I grew up on the West Coast. I didn't see anything live. It was always tape delayed. If Ed Sullivan takes his pants down, I'm not going to see him. To me, Johnny Carson was as live as you want to get. If you were bad, you were bad. Nobody did it over again. But you did it earlier. You didn't have to stay up until 11:30. So what happens when you stay up until 11:30? Guys like Belushi do 9 gallons of coke to make it up that late. I know from being a stand-up, the late show, the midnight show, was the one I hated the most. So my suggestion was, tape a show without stopping tape. Do one at 4, do one at 6:30, put the best of those two together, and show me that at 11:30. I'm in California, nothing's live. Dick Ebersol. So now we get to early April, and we're summoned back to New York to make a presentation to the then NBC program board, a fine group that I don't think made it out of that year. And when it's time to make the presentation, a guy whose name is Bob Howard, then president of the network under Schlosser, tells me, a few hours before the meeting, "You can't bring Michaels to the meeting because he's not an NBC employee. He's a freelance producer. We want to hear about the show from you." I said, "What?" So here's this presentation, which is largely Lorne's, and they won't let him in the room. Schlosser does sit in on it. I outlined the whole thing and finished and got stunned silence. Nobody says a word. Nothing. Herb finally says to Bill, "What do you think of it?" Bill Rudin was head of research, and he never wanted to have an opinion in his life until he heard the lay of the land. But he then uttered the famous words, "I don't think it'll ever work, because the audience for which it's designed will never come home on Saturday night to watch it." I went back and told Lorne how bad it had gone, and tried to keep him from being completely in a snit. 2 weeks later, Dave Tebbett, the network's head of talent, tells me, "You've got to go to Burbank right away. Carson wants to see you." Neither of us, Lorne or me, had a relationship with Johnny. We're both thinking our lives with this whole thing may be over, because this man, not only is he a genius, but our show is going to exist only because he doesn't want his repeats airing on the weekend. So we get to Burbank, and we're taken to Johnny's office. He's there with his producer, Fred DeCordova, who's dressed like Mr. Hollywood. And there's Johnny in a dirty undershirt, sweat stains under each arm, gray slacks. It's maybe 1:30 in the afternoon. Johnny said very little at the meeting. He just wanted to know a few things about the show. Then Fred DeCordova started into this thing about separation. They were talking about guests. We said we didn't have guests, but they said, "Yes, you do. You have these hosts." So we worked out this thing that nobody could be booked on the show for a month before a Tonight Show appearance, and we couldn't have them for a week or 2 weeks after. We were scared to death the whole time. So when we got out of there, we just went, "Whew!" Tom Schiller. The hip thing to do in those days was to go to the desert and eat hallucinogenic mushrooms. So we went to Joshua Tree, and Lorne did the mushrooms. I don't think I really took them myself. It just seems like I did. He was talking a blue streak about this television show he was going to do. He would just never stop. I was really surprised that he could still take phone calls from New York at the pool after he had ingested those mushrooms. He never becomes noticeably different under any circumstances. You can't get through the glaze of brown eyes. You can't go behind them. I didn't want to work in television. I wanted to be a great director, but I said yes to Lorne because I hated L.A. so much. When I first arrived in New York, I slept on the couch in Lorne's apartment. He would entertain people like Mick Jagger at the apartment, and Jagger would be sitting on the very couch that I was going to go to sleep on. I just couldn't wait for him to leave, because the second he got up, I would go to sleep. Lorne Michaels. So much of what Saturday Night Live wanted to be, or I wanted it to be when it began, was cool, which was something television wasn't, except in a retro way. Not that there weren't cool TV shows, but this was taking the sensibilities that were in music, stage, and the movies, and bringing them to television.